Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me.
As usual, is my cousin Tino.
My co-host, and sitting silently in the room playing with his iPod is our researcher and mind guest, Gary LeMaster.
This is Democratic Perspective, and so he calls that an iPod, does he?
That's true, isn't it? I'm new to the iPhone business.
Yes, that's okay. Call it anything he wants.
We have a caller today, Michael Austin. He's the provost and vice president of academic affairs at Neumann University in Topeka, Kansas. He's the author of a bunch of textbooks and books of literary criticism.
Well, yeah, we've had Michael on before, and he just keeps writing interesting stuff. If he would stop writing interesting stuff, we would not have him on a guest so often.
Yeah, and somebody from Kansas, and I'm from Oklahoma,
Kansas,
it's a tough thing. We've had him on. We're usually talking about the Constitution three times before. He's written a really great book called That's Not What They Meant, Reclaiming the Founding Fathers from America's Right Wing. Great book. We're talking with him today about his new book, Rereading Job, Understanding the Ancient World's Greatest Poem. And Michael, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. And I guess Michael, Mike, and I, and Gary too, we were all raised in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Catholic Church, the Old Testament, the Book of Job, doesn't have as much resonance, is not as talked about and discussed as much as it is, I think, in the Protestants that I was surrounded with when I was growing up in Oklahoma.
Right.
It's just not as central a focus as, at least as my memory, right on the New Testament. But the Book of Job just extends everywhere. Job is a prophet in Islam. They even have a place where he's buried, the south of Arabia. He's a prophet in the Druze religion, which is a local religion in Lebanon. And
right.
Yeah. And they even have a tomb for him there. The Palestinians have a place where he's buried.
Mm-hmm.
In the Quranic stories about him, he stamps his foot after all his suffering and creates a spring. There's a beautiful metaphor. What we're concerned about, I think, and Mike and I were talking a little bit before the show, is not only the suffering that we see personally,
mm-hmm.
which can be extremely great, but the suffering we see in the whole world. And does Job have anything, the dialogues in Job, the poetry of Job, have anything to relate to what we see? Because what Mike and I see is compassion fatigue, people turning off to what's happening, things being so terrible they can't even bear to, not only things happening to them, but they can't even bear to watch TV anymore. How many people have turned off and no longer watch network news?
Right. You know, the Book of Job, I think, has a lot to say about those issues, because they're human issues. They're not new. Profound suffering is very old in this world, and Job has quite a bit to say about it, especially the poem portion, because when you read Job, you have a pretty easy, more or less a fairy tale. That's the first two chapters, and then the very end of the last chapter. And that's what most people know about Job, and that's the story of the man who is tested by God, and he never speaks against God, and he gets all of his rewards at the end. That is probably 500 years older, that story, than the actual poem that constitutes the remainder of the book. And what the poem does is investigate and criticize the view that's expressed in that frame. This is a text that works against itself on a lot of levels. And it really tells us two things, I think, the poem. One is that the universe doesn't work like we think it works. And two is that when we try to make the universe work like we think it works, we end up hurting people and ignoring suffering and ignoring human compassion that we should be ignoring. Because what Job is really about, as I read it, is these three comforters, these three guys who have a way that they think the world is supposed to work. And that way is that if you do good things, God gives you good stuff. If you do bad things, God takes your stuff away or punishes you. There's a fairly immediate link between how God treats you and your moral worth as a human being. And that's what they want to believe. That's their religion. That's their understanding of the world. It gives them a lot of comfort because it gives them the ability to predict and control reality. I can predict and control reality if I know that if I push this lever, I get this treat, right?
But yeah. No serious religion in the world today believes in divine retribution, do they? Since the Inferno and Dante's little fiction trip, of course, the Catholics is snagged onto that because they liked it, because it was comfortable. And not just the Catholics, a lot of people like.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of divine retribution is, and I've been in a few, for want of a better term, fundamentalist churches, and that seems to come from the pulpit that there's some. But a theologian like yourself, I don't believe, voices or puts out divine retribution. There, you know, God, the finger of God isn't coming through the church roof to incinerate me every time I go.
The problems with that theory, and Job doesn't have anything to say about ultimate divine retribution. It has a lot to say about immediate divine retribution. So the book of Job says whether or not God rewards you or punishes you for your actions is irrelevant because you can't figure out the connection. And you can't treat other people like you can figure out the connection. You know, there may be a connection that God understands between your moral actions and your material circumstances, but God understands that because he's God. You don't understand that connection, and it's not as easy as you think it is. So that just because, if you believe that when you do good things you are rewarded, then you have to believe the flip side of that, which is when you don't do good things, you are not rewarded. So what we have in Job is a man who is suffering deeply, profoundly. It's a test case. They're the most awful sufferings that were imaginable at the time. And his three friends want to find the reason for that suffering. They're trying to figure out why Job is suffering, and they offer a whole bunch of different possibilities, but it mainly boils down to Job must have done something to tick off God. And that's exactly the message we're not supposed to get from Job. The message we're supposed to get from Job is that when people are suffering, then it is our responsibility to have compassion for people. It is not our responsibility to try to fit their suffering into our ideological framework.
But
is this when God appears in a whirlwind and says, he kind of one-ups them? He says, "Well, I created all of this. I created the universe. You didn't. I'm being crude, Mike, but
I love it. No,
but,
it sounds.
But doesn't it? You know, that's kind of his answer is, you know, I did this and you didn't. So what do you know?
Yes, Job continually asks God. You know, the idea of a patient Job comes from chapters 1 and 2.
Right.
The rest of the poem, Job isn't patient at all. He demands that God give him an answer. He demands that God justify himself. He demands that God, you know, get down here this minute and explain why you're making me suffer.
That's an excellent point. I mean, you know, the patience of Job has been a phrase that people have used for 2,500 years, I guess, but
that's because they only read the first two chapters.
Right.
Because the first two chapters are easy to read. The poem portion, which begins in chapter 3, is very difficult. We just kind of assume it means the same thing.
Right, right.
But when God does answer Job, he answers him from a whirlwind, and all he does is he asks him a bunch of questions. Where were you when I created this? Can you do this? Do you know how this works? Do you know? Can you tame the Leviathan? Can you encircle the behemoth so that he's tame? He asks him a bunch of questions that rhetorically, they say, Job, you don't know what I know. You can't do what I can do.
So I want to get back to the human compassion part. So if I'm reading this correctly and you correctly, that and Stephen correctly, that if we... The universe doesn't work the way we think it does. We want clarity. We want answers. We want this to have the stimulus, to have this reaction. And it doesn't work that way. Go ahead.
Job is a kind of literature which was very well known in the ancient world. It's a test case. The author takes a proposition and creates a thought experiment to test that proposition. And the proposition that the author is testing is there is always a connection that we can understand between somebody's material circumstances and their moral worth. So he gives us Job, a man who is suffering even though he is innocent. And that's the fundamental fact you can't explain away in Job. The author takes away everything we could use to explain that away.
Yes. So is that connection human compassion? Is that what the message we're supposed to get?
We get that in the negative because the comforters who should be giving him compassion, rather than approaching him compassionately and simply suffering with him, which they do in the frame. They sit with him for 7 days in the frame.
Right.
In the poem, though, rather than giving him the compassion that he needs and as a human being deserves, they try to figure out what his suffering means. They try to turn his suffering into something that can support their narrative of the universe. And I call that in the book an ideology.
Right.
They try to incorporate his suffering into their ideology, and when it won't fit, they hammer him. They hammer it so that it will fit, because what scares them the most is a universe that they can't understand, that they can't predict, that they can't control. And Job, by simply existing, is telling them that their ideology is wrong.
Say that slowly.
Because he's not being rewarded in the way he should be for his behavior.
Exactly.
In fact, he's being punished. And the outside of the poem, the frame of the poem, as you call it, has Satan, who I guess hadn't become the Satan of Christianity and later religion.
Yeah, he's more like a prosecuting attorney.
In some ways, to the simple view of it, it's kind of appalling. This Satan comes up to God and says, you know, how do you know that your righteous man is really righteous if he's getting rewarded so much? Maybe he just loves you because, you know, he's getting all this good stuff.
And what Satan is doing, see, one of the great fears that we should have when reading Job is that Satan is right. That ultimately we are motivated by rewards and punishment rather than innate morality. And in doing this, if we give in to the traditional understanding of retribution, then Satan is correct. If we do good things because there's a reward, even if it's a heavenly reward, because Christians have expanded the notion of reward and punishment to include heaven and hell, which really neither one of them was a thing at the time. But if we do good things, if we are compassionate, if we care for people, if we observe rites and rituals because we are expecting a reward or because we're afraid of a punishment, even if that punishment is a long way away, that ultimately isn't moral behavior. That's just enlightened self-interest.
Okay, so here's a test thought.
Okay.
Okay. Little old lady, we use a sort of the chauvinist view, but little old lady wants to cross the street.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell somebody, I will give you $500 if you will help her across the street.
Right.
Person helps the little old lady across the street. Has he done a good deed?
And, that's a profound moral and theological question. I think the deed is good because, in our example, helping a little old lady across the street is a good thing. So that is a good deed. But there's no moral value to that good deed because it's completely transactional.
So in the I'm going to say it again, theodicy?
Theodicy.
Theodicy. The quote from the MacLeish play, the Archibald MacLeish play. I want to talk about those for a second. I heard, here's the quote that's in your book. I heard upon his dry dung heap the man cry out who cannot sleep. If God is God, he is not good. If God is good, he is not God. So this whole question, and that word that you have, not, I guess it's not you, is, say it again, sir.
Theodicy.
Theodicy.
And that's from J.B.
J.B.
Yeah.
Yes.
Deals with the goodness of God, or the goodness or the non-goodness of God.
And that's a very old problem that is created when you believe in an omnipotent, all-powerful, benevolent deity.
I'm going to read the Aristotelian syllogism only because I wanted to say Aristotelian syllogism.
Okay.
Major premise, and we teach these things in English 101, believe it or not, at least in my 101 class. Nobody gets it, but I teach it. If there is a God who is omnibenevolent and omnipotent, then evil should not exist. We have this premise, and I believe it's a premise a lot of people have. If there's a God who is omnibenevolent, a good God, and omnipotent, then evil should not exist.
And when I lived in New York, I went around.
Evil exists.
Yeah. Huh? When I went around and asked religious figures, Hindu and Christian and Jewish and Muslim, about this, I remember I was sitting in a very exotic situation with a bunch of Turkish dervishes.
Mm-hmm.
And the sheikh was there. They stay up all night. They pass you little tiny cups of tea and coffee, and they sit up all night and they sing verses from the Quran and they preach and talk. And so I said to the sheikh, I said to all of them, if God is all good and perfect, how is it there's so much evil in the world? He said to me, he said, this life is a play. He said, it's theater. You play your part in it. And I suppose he didn't talk about paradise, but I suppose then he would go to the Christian Muslim thing that it may look like you're being horribly mistreated. This is Mike is talking about. It may look really like, but you're going to, in the next world or in paradise, things are going to be made up and things will be good.
That's really, yeah, that's the Christian and the Muslim expansion of the afterlife, well beyond what was possible in Jewish thought in the 5th century B.C., that we simply take the law of retribution or the idea that God balances everything out, and we say, well, okay, it doesn't work in this world, but there's this eternal world afterwards, and it will all balance out then.
Yeah, that's basically what he's saying. This is a play. Play your part. Be a good human being, and there'll be another play.
The problem with doing it that way, though, the problem with thinking like that, in my opinion, is that you still are doing things for reward or for fear of punishment. I mean, it's still a carrot. It's just a carrot that's a lot farther away.
That's right. That's
so you're just chasing a farther carrot. But that's not the same thing as being good.
So I'm doing all these good deeds. I spend my whole life doing good deeds. And I do that in expectation that I'm going to heaven or paradise and going to be rewarded for it. Am I doing good deeds?
That's what Satan asks God at the beginning of the book of Job. You know, because there's no real intrinsic difference between a new car and heaven. They're both rewards. Or between between leprosy and hell. They're both punishments.
If you're
doing things because you expect to be rewarded, and you would not do those things if you didn't expect to be rewarded, then where's the moral value? Because if that's the case, then Satan is right. And if Satan is right, we've got problems in the universe.
Well, yes, exactly. That if you're doing these things, but that bears repeating. If you're doing these things because you want a pat on the wherever you want your pat, then there is no moral goodness in it. And if you're doing them out of moral goodness, then you don't expect reward.
And that's the hard thing. I mean, that's what Job wants us to imagine is a universe where there is no connection, or at least no connection that we as human beings can ever understand between what we deserve and what we get.
Well, that's it. I think Job and some of these other interpreters of Job, this is where that phrase comes from. If you think you understand, it's not God kind of thing.
Right.
But I do want to get back to the human compassion thing, because quite frankly, it's the only part of this discussion that
So what should his friends do? Right, like what should his friends do? They come in and they say, and instead of being compassionate and sitting with him in the real sense, being with him, they sort of lecture him and question him about, you know, you must have done something bad. Now, didn't you really do something bad? And aren't you really being punished for doing something bad?
It's your impure thoughts.
What they do,
why don't you just confess?
Try to distill it to something that can be useful today. They allow ideology to trump compassion.
Yes.
What they do is they try to make Job's suffering fit their narrative. And this is something that I think most of us do most of the time when we see people suffering, whether it's our religious narrative or our political narrative. Mm. We try to use that suffering to justify our ideology, or we fit that suffering into our ideology.
Make ideology trump compassion. You know, that seems to ring so clear with so many of, you know, the Pope is coming to Congress in September, and I believe he's going to put every one of those Republicans over the banister and spank them hard for their lack of compassion for the American people, for the simple things that we could do for health care, the simple things we could do for feeding people, the simple things we could do to keep our children alive, at least. If we can't keep the children alive in Africa, okay, maybe we should. That comes next. But let's not have our infant mortality rate rival that of some third world country. So I believe the Pope is just gearing up to give a moral spanking.
I think he probably will, and I think it'll be a very good. I hope he quotes Job. But you know, Job's comforters. Job's
I hope
friends,
he quotes Michael Austin.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
They just spend the whole time. When what they should be doing is just sitting there and putting their arms around Job and giving him a hug and saying, "We love you," they spend the whole time trying to make his suffering make sense according to their ideological narrative. And as a result, they fail miserably as friends. Hmm. I mean, they're like literature's and theology's great example of bad friends.
Hmm.
And the reason is because they can't see through. They can't see the person through their ideological narrative.
Yeah, how many times do you go to a friend for support and you get the friend focused on himself rather than on your particular suffering, or you get a lecture about this and that, or that's just utterly common. Job has been, well, there must be 1,000 paintings of Job. He's inspired all these different religions. He's inspired a whole literature that you talk about and others talk about, of, you know, from Blake to the poem that Mike's quoting or play
from maybe Archibald MacLeish.
Yeah, Archibald MacLeish.
And we are going to talk. We're not done with poetry yet here, because we're going to talk about Alexander Pope. And the you know, there's a phrase that goes around, whatever it is.
Whatever is right, is what Pope says.
Yes, and well, I'm saying that, but it is what it is.
It is what it is.
That's the phrase that we. I'm tired of by 2015, because it says so little. But I'm going to have new respect for it, maybe, since, and you know where I'm going here, Michael, that in Pope says, all nature is but art, unknown to thee. That discord harmony, I'm paraphrasing now, discord harmony is not understood. Partial evil is universal good, all spite of pride and Aryan reason sprite. One truth is clear. Whatever is how he ends this thing. You know, the goodness, evil, harmony, discord, nature is but art. And that's exactly what Stephen was saying about life being a play when he was talking to his dervishes and
Yeah, what he's saying on one level is somebody else wrote the play. He's saying pretty much what you get from Job. Somebody else wrote the play. You play your part in it. You do the right thing for yourself or the right thing you're supposed to do. But it, then I suppose then he didn't say is that if you're a good whatever, then you get rewarded in paradise. He didn't say that, but that was, I think, coming from the Muslim tradition, that would be what he meant. And that was what we were just talking about earlier.
Well, what Pope is offering there, and Pope is working with Leibniz, who was a German theologian and mathematician and philosopher. But Pope is giving one possible answer to the question that Job raises of why evil exists. And Pope's answer, which is also Leibniz's answer, is evil exists because we don't see the whole picture. And if we saw the whole picture, we would realize that it's perfect.
All right.
But yeah, but all we see is a part of it. We have this idea that things are wrong or evil, but that's just our lack of perspective that makes that so.
All right. A young child, innocent child, gets a horrible diseases and suffers for years and years and years. Pretty hard to understand any reason for that.
Well, and according to Pope and according to Leibniz, you never will, because our human understanding is too limited to even get how God thinks. Because what the whole picture, if you could see the whole picture, the whole universe, all time, all space, as one great big interconnected whole, you would see how perfect it is.
Well, that's it. The puny standards of man, you know, can't envelop
right.
the mind of God.
All right, but if that's true, let's assume that's true. What are the implications for us as human beings and watching, you know, looking at all the horrible stuff that happens to us? And looking at, you know, I mean, you have now ISIS running around beheading people, killing people, raping women, killing, trying to exterminate whole peoples because they disagree with their religion. You have this, and then Boko Haram is even worse in Africa. You have absolutely vicious, vicious stuff going on. So how do you... What's the implication of not understanding the whole picture for those of us who are not going to understand the whole picture?
Before you answer, I want to these groups do is beyond our understanding of goodness, you know.
And that's a very good question, and that's the rebuttal to Pope and Leibniz was given also in the 18th century by Voltaire, who wrote a spectacular little novella called Candide. And the main purpose of Candide is to challenge the Pope Leibniz narrative that the universe is just spiffy if we understood it well. And so
I saw that, but it doesn't help. Go ahead, it help.
He goes all over the world, and all he finds is bad stuff.
Yeah.
You know, earthquakes and torture and war and people being massacred. And at the very end, he meets a dervish, a Turkish dervish. They're in Byzantium. And, well, it's Istanbul now. Yeah, but the dervish tells them, you know, he asks, why do people suffer? And the dervish tells him, do you think that when the sultan sends a ship to another country, he cares about the rats? We suffer because we're just rats in God's universe. It's a very depressing view
of
God. That just says, you know, human beings are just utterly unimportant in God's mind in the great plan.
Well, that's the exact opposite of the personal God who cares so much about you.
Right.
Right. That's the exact polar opposite of you. But where does that lead? I mean, Voltaire is a compassionate guy. He cares about human progress and all the good things that, you know, given his century and all of that. He doesn't give up on that, but that's the bleakest vision of how the world is structured.
I think where Voltaire wants us to go, and I think at least a very strong reading of Job, I think, says the same thing, and that is stop thinking about the afterlife, stop thinking about God's plan, stop thinking about why things happen. There may be one, but you don't understand it, and you never will. So when you see suffering... your job is to mourn with those that mourn, to comfort those who stand in need of comfort. It's not to figure it out. So so what that reading of Job and of the universe does is it says, just deal with the people that you see, the suffering that you see, express compassion, don't make it about theology. I mean, it's really, I think, an anti-theological work, because it's just saying that trying to figure it out isn't the point. You're never going to do it. It's not going to work. The way you comfort somebody is to just sit there and suffer with them.
I think that's particularly hard for men to do. I think women, at least in our culture, have an easier time understanding that. We always greet somebody suffering by saying, what can we do to help? I mean,
right.
Can I bring you a glass of water? You know, whatever it is, we always think, what can I do? And when we can't do anything, we get extremely frustrated and I think shut down.
And we have this strange idea that explaining the suffering somehow helps them.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and that thing about, God is God, you can't understand, and, we don't know his crap. And just a really excuse, talk about another excuse for abandoning human compassion. Tell us about God on trial. Three Jews walk into a bar. If I read the beginning of God on Trial correctly.
Yeah, that's a play by Elie Wiesel, who was a Holocaust survivor. He was a young child in Auschwitz. And wrote a gripping memoir about that called Night. And the trial of God it takes place in the Ukraine in about the 1600s, right after a big pogrom that has killed almost all of the Jews in the countryside. And so a group of Purim Spielers are people who at the time of Purim go around the countryside acting Purim plays, the story of Haman and Esther and other scriptural plays, and they ask if they can perform a Purim spiel in exchange for their lodging and meal. And Beresh, who's the innkeeper, he and his daughter are the only two Jews left in the community, say they don't want to see a Purim spiel, but if they want, if the players want food and lodging, they'll do a play that's a trial of God. Mm-hmm. And they will put God on trial for crimes against humanity.
How does that turn out?
Pardon me?
How does that trial turn out?
Well, the guy who comes up to defend God turns out to be Satan.
Ah.
And Beresh, the innkeeper, is the prosecutor. And so you go through Satan defending God. It's very interesting there. But before the verdict can be reached, another pogrom starts and everybody is killed.
Oh. Very Shakespearean.
Right.
Everybody's died on the end of the stage. So we avoid the trial. So the very imaginative author in the 16th century put God on trial.
Well, no, the author was 20th century.
Yeah, he's 20th century.
He said it in the 16th century. But the author was a man who lived through the Holocaust.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Right now. Sorry, and Eli Wetzel.
So there's, again, no resolution to the trial of God in his work.
No.
And, you have all the great literary figures in our tradition, like Blake coming up with very different answers and pictures of Job and God and what can we learn, and I guess in a concrete way, I mean, what we see again, as I mentioned earlier, is people turning off because there's so much suffering in the world. It seems so hard to do anything at all about it. A lot of the stuff we do turns out bad. We see some bad guys. We start a war. We get even more people killed than when the bad guy was in power. And we generate all kinds of unexpected consequences.
A lot of suffering.
I'm not sure that Job helps us there. Job, I think, tells us how not to respond to suffering. I don't think it gives us that many ideas about how we should.
I see.
Except that in the very beginning, in the frame, before the comforters start trying to fit Job into their narratives, they just sit and don't say a word for 7 days. To me, that's the best idea.
Just
shut up for a while and listen.
What about God for grown-ups? When I, it's a long story, but and that's kind of what we're talking about here, is that transition of going from, and I think your book and the book of Job and his other interpreters kind of take this to a new level. They take lessons out of Job. They, meaning youth pastors or whatever, people in your position, theologians, will take lessons out of Job that suits them. And
I'd say, when I went on the internet to look at a lot of interpretation of Job, most of them are, I would say, what we would call fundamentalist little moral tales. So they'll be the ten takeaways from reading Job, and they're the very, very standard sort of thing. And I think what you're getting at.
My point is, most people study religion, including Job, and all, exactly what you're talking about, have a child's. They grew up as a Mormon. They grew up as a Catholic. They grew up as whatever, and they carry that childhood. A paradigm of their religion into their adulthood. And then, somewhere along the line, they're supposed to get an adult view of their religion if they want to keep it. If they want, or they do what most rational people do, they abandon religion because there is no logic or reason in it. And they go on, and whatever, you know, churches are losing membership left and right in many places.
Is it because they're not answering fundamental questions anymore? Well, because people don't believe their fundamental questions?
They don't transition from their childhood view of the religion to their adult view of the religion. And Job, I think Michael Austin in his book says as much, maybe, is that this is an adult review of religion, Michael?
Yeah, and that, you know, the idea of the grown-up God comes from a philosopher named Emmanuel Levinas, who was a Ukrainian Jewish soldier in World War II. He was actually a French POW, so he was not in the concentration camps. But he wrote a lot about religion, a lot about ethics, and in what he said is that the questions that come out of even horrible events about God tend to assume a very childish view of God.
Yeah.
God is a kindergarten teacher. He gives you things. He punishes you if you do wrong. He lets you take naps. That's a child's God. The child's God is always giving you candy.
But the big religions have their transition. The Jews have their bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah. The Catholics have their confirmation. I'm sure the Mormons got something. And where you're supposed to go from childhood to it.
Well, the approaching God as an adult, what Levinas says is it's very similar to the relationship between a child and a parent, and then between an adult and their parent.
Right.
You know, I have a very good relationship with my parents. I'm 48, and we've worked out an adult relationship. It's not the same as it was when I was 7.
No matter how hard they tried, I don't know.
Right. You have to change your relationship with the parent when you become a grown-up.
Right.
And Levinas would say you have to change your relationship with God when you become a grown-up.
So dropping the illusions would actually, in some ways,
Job is a good map for how to go from childhood view of God to.
I think it's a very good map, and it requires. If you try to read Job with the childhood God, you never get past chapter 2.
Right, exactly, right. And that's what, like you said, a lot of people do.
And I guess what I was thinking, what I was taking away from this was, and you know, in the Catholic Church, there's one explanation for the peasants, and then there's another explanation for the intellectuals. I mean, you can go all the way up, and it gets more and more complicated. But what I take away from this is that if you understand Job, and you understand the implications of Job, it actually makes you stronger and more able to deal with the horror and evil in the world.
I do think that's true. I mean, I think that some very powerful explanations of suffering come through people reading Job in certain ways, like Emmanuel Levinas and Elie Wiesel.
Well, I remember this is once again a personal note, and I'm the lightest weight of the lightweights, but my whole, and I have no idea where I got it from, I'm sure I stole it from somebody, was trying to get, I taught social justice in to Catholic men and women. Mostly young men and women trying to for their confirmation experience, and it was definitely another life. Well, this is like radio confession time. But the idea was to transition from their view as children of their religion to an adult. This is if you stick around, then this is the adult view of your religion. And I used social justice, I cooked this up with some other religious person in the church as the transition from the childhood view of their religion, like they were raised. God gives you candy, and you know all the other the ceremonies that churches come up with for children to keep them going. The little rituals, which are all nice, and they dress them in nice dresses and whatnot. And then, what do we do as adults? Well, this is what we do as adults. We care about each other. We get involved in social justice projects. We go to Central America. We go to South America. We go to Indonesia, and we build water. We get some fresh water, and we learn how to rotate crops. And this is what we do as adults.
But why should we do that, Mike?
I ask Michael.
Michael,
well,
why should we do that? Why should we do all those?
I just
sounds like liberation theology
we
to me.
We should do that because being a moral adult means having genuine compassion for other people and wanting to improve their lives and limit their suffering.
Limit their suffering.
And there's no reward. Are we not expecting? How do we know whether there's a reward or not?
It doesn't matter if there's a reward. If you're an adult,
or reincarnation. How do we know whether there's reincarnation or not?
If you're a child, it matters. If you're a grown-up, it doesn't matter.
That's right. That's excellent. I wish I want to go back and teach those classes because I left that part out.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't close the circle because I didn't have the intellectual freight, you know, to get that far. But, you know, everybody kind of nodded and went along with it, and it was a whole as a piece of instruction, but it wasn't as a piece of theology until now.
I suppose if you do good in the kind of thing that Mike is talking about, then you become a kind of creator of the world too, right? You create the world as it should be. If we behave in a compassionate way, then we help to create the world and move the world along. So we're tiny little co-creators or something of the universe.
A very good way to look at it.
Yeah, let's take this full circle too. We started talking about the young lady from Prescott who's, they're talking about in the news a lot right now because she was captured by ISIS and is probably, gone, but,
2 minutes, Mike.
Montini's column, we have a writer here at the Arizona Republic, E.J. Montini, and he said, he gave like a mock conversation between someone and talking to her parents. He said, what does your daughter do? Answer, she saves the world. and just what nicer thing could you say about your child? Or anyone for that matter? And then he goes on to explain how, you know, she's not saving the world, but if she's doing what she's doing, but anyway, that's our full circle. For we started talking about this poor young woman over in there, Michael, great book. Give him the name of it.
The book Rereading Job.
Rereading Job, understanding the ancient world's greatest poem. We can argue about whether it's the ancient world's greatest poem. I'm an Odyssey guy, but certainly you make a case for it. Brilliant book, great book to start doing this.
1 minute.
Dora's going to have a breakfast, Gary, right next Thursday, not this coming Thursday, but the Thursday after this, with a speaker about morality and corruption. See if I can read it without my glasses. It'll be at the Sedona Bar and Grill at 8 a.m.
Okay.
Yeah. And the other thing is, the next week we're having another of our kind of non-political shows, and Mike's put it together. It's on the Verde River, and so I hope we'll get Noam Chomsky on, and because I wanted to talk to him not about so much about politics, about what are the rights of nature,
what is our
relationship to nature, Mike.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on your Noam Chomsky. Water is the new oil, folks, and we've heard this before, but we're going to talk about the Verde River, our little river here, right next week. Please tune in.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.